spilling of the blood and the disgrace to the head, the most ritually sacred part of the body, defiled the dead man's soul, and tying it to the most obscene part of the horse, shamed his whole family. Reportedly, Jamukha then boiled 70 young male captives alive in cauldrons, a form of death that would have destroyed their souls and thus completely annihilated them. Since 7 represents an unlucky number for the Mongols, this story of 70 cauldrons may well have been an embellishment for dramatic effect. But the secret history makes clear that whatever he really did, in the wake of this victory, Jamukha horrified people greatly and harmed his image. This display of unwarranted cruelty by Jamukha further emphasized the divisions between the old aristocratic lineages based on inherited power and the abused lower-ranking ones based on ability and personal loyalty. The episode proved a decisive turning point for Temujin, who had lost the battle, but gained public support and sympathy among the Mongols, who were increasingly fearful of the cruelty of Jamukha. Temujin's warriors had been routed, but they would slowly collect together again behind their young Khan. His rivalry with Jamukha was not yet resolved, but in 1195, when Temujin was 33, an unexpected opportunity arose for a foreign raid and substantial plunder that would greatly increase his military prestige and his economic power among the Mongols. The civilized Jurchid rulers of Cathay, to the south of the Gobi, frequently delved into steppe politics as a way of keeping the tribes at war with one another and thus too weak to threaten their own power. Although traditionally the allies of the Tatars, the Jurchid feared the Tatars were growing too strong, and they instigated Ong Khang to raise an army to attack them. Ong Khang again enlisted the aid of Temujin in a quickly arranged alliance with the Golden Khan of the Jurchid, so that they might jointly attack and plunder the much richer Tatar tribe. In the winter of 1196, the Cariad ruler Ong Khang and Temujin with his Mongol followers set out on their campaign against the Tatars. Their raid, carried out according to the same tactics used in typical steppe raids, but on a larger scale, brought quick and easy success. Temujin was profoundly impressed by the sumptuous booty that warfare could yield. Because of their proximity to the Jurchid kingdom and the more sophisticated manufactured goods of the Chinese Empire, the Tatars owned more trade goods than any other tribe on the steppe. Among the goods seized, the secret history mentions the impression made on the Mongols by a cradle embossed with silver and covered by a silken blanket embroidered with golden threads and pearls. Even captured Tatar children wore satin clothes decorated with golden threads. In one case, a young boy wore a gold ring in his nose, and one in each ear. The ragged Mongols had never seen such luxurious goods worn by anyone, much less a child. Temujin saw clearly how the powerful Jurchid kingdom used one border tribe to fight another. One year, they might ally with the Tatars against the Cariad, but the next year, with the Cariad and Mongols against the Tatars. Today's allies could be tomorrow's enemies, as in the case of Jamukha. And a tribe conquered today would have to be conquered again and again in a ceaseless cycle of warfare and feuding. No victory was ever decisive, no peace permanent. This lesson would eventually have a profound effect on the new world Temujin would fashion out of this havoc. But for now, the vicissitudes of this particular war had brought an unprecedented number of goods to his people and had improved his standing among them. Temujin still had a struggle ahead of him against Jamukha for control of the Mongols. The wealth looted from the Tatars attracted more followers. He now began to increase his power over other Mongol lineages and to expand into their territories. he could not expand into the area of the great tribes. But he could push out the smaller ones, such as the Jurchen, a small Mongol lineage located immediately to the south of Temujin's group along the Harlan River. When Temujin had agreed to fight the Tatars, he had enlisted the help of his Jurchen relatives, who had initially agreed to join him. But when Temujin was prepared to leave for the campaign, he waited for 6 days for the Jurchen to arrive, and they never did. Just as with a Hurultai, where showing up counted as a vote of support, not showing up to organize raids constituted a vote of no confidence in the raid's leader, in this case, Temujin. Relations between the Jurchen and Temujin's followers had been strained before. Like almost everyone around them, the Jurchen lineage outranked Temujin's lineage, and they often treated Temujin and his followers with scorn. One colorful story told in the secret history reveals the animosity that had developed between the groups. Temujin had invited the Jurchen to a feast, shortly before the Tatar campaign was to begin. But a chaotic brawl erupted when Temujin's half-brother was assaulted in an especially demeaning way. Belgate was the appointed guardian of the horses for Temujin's band, and he stood watch over them as the feast got underway. When a man, apparently from the Jurchen group, attempted to steal one of the horses, Belgate chased him but was stopped by another Jurchen known as Bur the Wrestler. As a sign that he stood ready to fight Bur, Belgate pulled the top of his clothing down, leaving most of his upper body exposed. Rather than wrestle Belgate, as would have been the custom in a disagreement among equals, Bur treated Belgate with contempt as a lesser by unsheathing his sword and slicing Belgate across the shoulder with it. To draw blood in this manner, even with just a small cut, constituted a grave insult. Learning of what had taken place outside by the horses, the drunken guests began fighting among themselves. As was customary, they had entered the feast without their weapons. So the guests began throwing the dishes of food at one another and clubbing each other with the paddles used to stir the fermented mare's milk that had been consumed in great quantity. Not only had the Jurchen failed to join Temujin's force in the fight against the Tatars, they now took advantage of Temujin's absence by raiding his base camp, killing 10 of his followers, and stripping the remainder of their clothes and other possessions. So when Temujin sought to expand his territory of rule in the wake of victory against the Tatars, the Jurchen were the first he struck out against. He launched his campaign against them in 1197, and in a testament to his now well-honed skills as a warrior and commander, he easily defeated them. At this point, Temujin instituted the second radical change in ruling style, the first being the appointment of loyal allies as opposed to family members to key positions in his entourage that would mark his rise to power. In the long history of steppe warfare, a defeated tribe was looted, some members taken prisoner, and the rest left again to their own devices. Defeated groups regularly reorganized and counterattacked, or broke away and joined rival tribes. In his defeat of the Jurchen, however, Temujin followed a radical new policy that revealed his ambition to fundamentally alter the cycle of attack and counterattack and of making and breaking alliances. He summoned a Hurultai of his followers to conduct a public trial of the Jurchen's aristocratic leaders for having failed to fulfill their promise to join him in war and for having instead raided his camp in his absence. Finding them guilty, he had them executed as a lesson about the value of loyalty to allies, but also as a clear warning to the aristocrats of all lineages that they would no longer be entitled to special treatment. He then took the unprecedented step of occupying the Jurchen lands and redistributing the remaining members of their group among the households of his own clan. Though some among both clans apparently interpreted this as the Jurchen being taken as slaves, as would have been more in keeping with steppe custom, according to the account in the secret history, Temujin took them into his tribe not as slaves, but as members of the tribe in good standing. He symbolized this by adopting an orphan boy from the Jurchen camp and presenting him to Oilun to raise in her Ger not as a slave but as her son. By having his mother adopt the Jurchen boy, as he had her previously adopt one each from the defeated Merkid, Tayitshud, and Tatars, Temujin was accepting the boys as his younger brothers. Whether these adoptions began for sentimental reasons or for political ones, Temujin displayed a keen appreciation of the symbolic significance and practical benefit of such acts in uniting his followers through this usage of fictive kinship. In the same way that he took these children into his own family, he accepted the conquered people into his tribe with the possibility that they would share fairly in the future conquests and prosperity of his army. In a final display of his new power, Temujin ended the Jurchen episode with a feast for both the victorious Mongols and their newly adopted relatives. For the feast, he summoned Bur the Wrestler, who had cut Belgate at the feast the year before, and ordered a wrestling match between the two men. No one had ever defeated Bur, but in his fear of Temujin's wrath, he allowed Belgate to throw him. Normally, at this point, the match would have been finished, but Temujin and Belgate apparently worked out a different plan. Belgate seized Bur's shoulders and mounted his rump like a horse, and upon receiving a signal from Temujin, he plunged his knee into Bur's back and snapped his spinal cord. Belgate then dragged Bur's paralyzed body outside the camp, leaving him to die alone. Temujin had rid himself of all the leaders of the Jurchen. The messages were clear to all their related clans on the steppe. To those who followed Temujin faithfully, there would be rewards and good treatment. To those who chose to attack him, he would show no mercy. After defeating the Jurchen, he moved his followers downstream on the Herlin into their territory. Temujin made his new base camp near the confluence of the smaller Senka River with the Herlin. Eventually this became his capital, known as Avraga. But at this time, it was only a remote camp. The land between two rivers was called Aral, island in Mongolian. Because the island between the Senker and Herlin rivers offered a wide open pasture, they called it Holdoy Aral, which in modern Mongolian means country island, but in classical Mongolian carried the meaning barren island, and that name is an apt description for this isolated place in the midst of a large, open, and treeless prairie. Barren as Avraga may have been, it constitutes on a grand scale the steppe herder's ideal home territory. Herders desire a Ger that faces south in order to admit the light and warmth of the southern sun through the entryway, as well as to prevent the cold northern winds from entering. They want to face water, but not be too close. A 30-minute walk from the river seems to be the right distance to avoid polluting it with too much human waste. That distance also provides protection from the summer insects and flash floods that sometimes rage along the river plains. In addition to these advantages, Avraga was still close to the place of Temujin's birth, and to the sacred mountain Burhan Khaldun, which rose about 130 miles upstream at the headwaters of the Herlin River. Avraga offered all of this, and from 1197 to the end of his life, it served as Temujin's operations base. Although Temujin's followers prospered for 4 years in their new home as the size of his tribe continued to grow, Jamukha refused to recognize his leadership and increasingly became the rallying figure for the aristocratic clans who did not like the changes Temujin was bringing to their traditional way of life. In 1201, the year of the cock, Jamukha made a play, with their support, for the position of ruler of all the Mongol people. In a challenge to both Temujin and Ong Khan, Jamaka summoned a Hurultai that conferred upon him the ancient and honored title of Gurkha, or Gurkhan, which meant chief of all chiefs, or Khan of all Khans. His people swore a new oath of loyalty to him, and to sanctify the oath, they cut up one stallion and one mare in sacrifice. Jamukha had not chosen the ancient title merely because it was old. He had a more directly sinister motive. The last Khan to bear the title of Gurkhan had been Ong Khan's uncle, who had ruled the Karayid people until Ong Khan revolted against him and killed him and his brothers. It was during this revolt that Temujin's father, Yesige, became the ally of Ong Khan. By choosing this title, Jamaka was publicly challenging the power of Ong Khan, as well as his subordinate Temujin. If Jamaka could win this war, he would be the supreme ruler of the central steppe. He had on his side the important and aristocratic clans, such as the Tayachud, to which Temujin's family had once been subservient, and who had enslaved Temujin when he was a boy. The struggle that began to shape up between the two Mongol factions portended to be more than just a series of raids for loot and captives. It would be a death struggle between Jamaka and Temujin for leadership of all the Mongols. As the sponsor for Temujin, Ong Khan organized his warriors and came out to personally lead the campaign against Jamaka. The primary objective of such campaigns was never to have to actually fight a battle at all, but instead to frighten the other side by overwhelming force so that they would flee. To induce this fear, the steppe warriors relied on many tactics. One of those was the display of the spirit banners of the opposing leaders and their ancestors. Before battle, the warriors made animal sacrifices before the spirit banners as an offering to their guiding spirits and to their ancestors. Such spiritual dramas whipped up emotions and heightened tension. A lineage on one side would find it very difficult to fight if kinsmen on the other side had paraded the spirit banner of their common ancestor. That would be tantamount to attacking one's own grandfather. The pre-battle propaganda also involved shamans with their drums and all their ritual paraphernalia. Before the battle, the rival shamans foretold the future by reading the cracks in the burned shoulder bones of sheep. The presence of a shaman showed that he had forecast victory for his side, and the power of that forecast depended on his past reputation for choosing the winning side. Temujin had already attracted a number of shamans who revealed dreams to him, including one named Teb Tengger, who would later play an important role. The shamans added to the occasion by climbing up on a promontory to pound their drums and beat magical rocks with which they could summon supporting spirits and control the weather. The objective was to entice warriors on the other side to defect to the superior side or to flee. When Jamaka pitted his army against the Karayid, the numerical advantage clearly belonged to Ong Khan and Temujin. The psychological advantage of Temujin's cadre of respected shamans strengthened his position, especially after a tremendous storm erupted with intense thunder and lightning that both sides attributed to the magic of the shamans. Many of Jamaka's followers fled in fright, forcing Jamaka to retreat. Ong Khan's warriors chased after Jamaka and the main part of his army, and he ordered Temujin to follow the Tayachud as they fled back toward the Onon River, the land where Temujin had grown up and which he knew well. When Temujin caught up with the Tayachud, they proved more difficult to defeat than expected. The steppe mode of warfare consisted primarily of shooting arrows at one another from horseback, or from fixed positions behind the protection of rocks, or in the case of the wooded Onon area, hastily assembled log barricades. When fighting, the steppe warriors sought to avoid being splattered by blood, so they rarely fought close to one another in hand-to-hand combat. The breath or odor of the enemy carried a part of his soul, and thus warriors sought to avoid the contamination of even smelling their enemy. The attackers swarmed down toward their enemies on horseback, firing arrows rapidly as they approached, then turned and continued firing as they fled. Sometimes the defenders rode out with long poles, with which they tried to dismount their opponents and then shoot them as they stumbled back to their feet. Temujin's army and the Taichud fought all day without either side gaining a clear advantage, though Temujin's forces apparently instilled the greater fear of defeat in their foes. According to the account in the Secret History, late in the day, an arrow pierced Temujin Khan's neck. As darkness fell, the two opposing armies laid down their arms and made camp close to each other on the same field where they had spent the day fighting. Though this may seem strange, by staying close together during the night, they could more effectively watch each other and prevent a surprise attack. Though Temujin's wound was not deep, he lost consciousness after sunset. Such wounds carried a high risk of infection, or possibly poison had been applied to the arrow. His loyal follower Jelm, the next in command, stayed by his side throughout the evening and sucked the blood from the wound. In order to prevent offending the earth by spitting the blood on the ground, Jelm swallowed it. In addition to the religious reasons for his acts, hiding the blood had the practical value of preventing the other warriors from seeing how great the blood loss was. Only when Jelm was too full to swallow any more, and the blood began trickling down from his mouth, did he begin to spit it onto the ground. After midnight, Temujin temporarily regained consciousness and begged to drink irak, fermented mare's milk. Because they had camped on the battlefield, Jelm had nothing but a little water, but he knew that in the middle of their camp, the Taichud had several supply wagons drawn up in a defensive circle. He stripped off his clothes, slipped across the battlefield, and walked naked among the enemy soldiers in search of irak. For a Mongol, public nakedness is a great sign of debasement. And had one of the Taichud seen him going through the camp naked at night, they probably would have assumed that he was one of their own getting up to relieve himself. Out of politeness, they probably would have looked away for fear of shaming one of their own warriors. Had they looked carefully and recognized him, Jelm planned to claim that he had just been stripped and humiliated by his fellow Mongols and had escaped to the Taichud. They would probably have believed him, because of the unlikelihood that any proud Mongol warrior would intentionally allow himself to be captured naked. The Taichud did not awaken, and although Jelm could not find irak, he did find a bucket of fermenting curds and took them. He brought the curds back, mixed them with water, and fed them to Temujin throughout the night. As the morning light came, Temujin's sight cleared, and he saw the blood around him and his half-dressed companion. He was confused and asked what had happened. Upon hearing the account of the night, his discomfort at the sight of his own blood on the ground so close to him made him ask, "Couldn't you have spit it somewhere else?" Despite the apparent lack of gratitude, Temujin never forgot how Jelm saved him from the Taichud, and he later entrusted Jelm with some of the most important expeditions of the Mongol conquests. The episode of the neck wound is emblematic of the deep bonds of loyalty that Temujin seemed to have a gift of inspiring. Though the steppe tribes of his time changed sides at the least provocation, and soldiers might desert their leaders, none of Temujin's generals deserted him throughout his 6 decades as a warrior. In turn, Temujin never punished or harmed one of his generals. Among the great kings and conquerors of history, this record of fidelity is unique. The Taichud did not know of Temujin's wound, and during the night, many of them began to sneak off the battlefield. By the next morning, most of the warriors had fled, and Temujin sent his warriors in pursuit. As he had done with the defeated Jurkin, Temujin killed off most of their leaders, but accepted the rest as his own followers. Some 30 years after his initial capture by the Taichud and imprisonment in the Kang, he rewarded the family that had helped him to escape by freeing them from bondage. While Temujin had been defeating the Taichud, Jamukha escaped from the army of Ong Khan. Although Jamukha had lost the Taichud, he still had many other clans loyal to him, and as he fled to more distant parts of the steppe, he would enlist new allies as well to join his cause. The final showdown between him and Temujin had not yet come. In 1202, the year of the dog, the year following Temujin's defeat of the Taichud, Ong Khan sent Temujin on another campaign to plunder the Tatars in the east, while he, the aging Khan, stayed closer to home on another campaign against the Merkit. In this campaign against the Tatars, Temujin would institute yet another set of radical changes to the rules that had long governed steppe life, and these changes would both antagonize some of his followers, those of the aristocratic lineages, and deepen the loyalty felt for him by many others, those of the lower lineages whose lives he enriched with his reforms and distribution of goods. While conducting raid after raid, Temujin had realized that the rush to loot the gurs of the defeated served as an impediment to more complete victory. Rather than chasing down the warriors of the raided camps, attackers generally allowed them to flee and focused instead on immediately looting their camps. This system allowed many defeated warriors to escape and eventually return for a counterattack. So on this raid, his second conquest of the Tatars, Temujin decided to order that all looting would wait until after a complete victory had been won over the Tatar forces. The looting could then be carried out in a more organized fashion, with all the goods being brought under his central control and then redistributed among his followers as he determined fit. He distributed the goods along the same lines by which the hunting men of the forest traditionally distributed the kill at the end of a group hunt. In another innovation, he ordered that a soldier's share be allocated to each widow and to each orphan of every soldier killed in the raid. Whether he did this because of the memory of his own mother's predicament when the Tatars killed his father, or for more political purposes, it had a profound effect. This policy not only ensured him of the support of the poorest people in the tribe, but it also inspired loyalty among the soldiers, who knew that even if they died, he would take care of their surviving families. After routing the Tatars, some of Temujin's followers ignored his order against individual looting, and he demonstrated how serious he was about this reform by exacting a tough but appropriate punishment. He stripped those men of all their possessions and deprived them of the goods seized in the campaign. By controlling the distribution of all the looted goods, he had again violated the traditional rights of the aristocratic lineages under him to disperse the goods among their followers. The radical nature of his reforms angered many of them, and some deserted him to join the forces of Jamukha at this point, further drawing a line between the higher prestige lineages and the common herders. Again, he had shown that rather than relying on the bonds of kinship and tradition, members of his tribe could now look to Temujin for direct support. With this move, he greatly centralized the power of his rule, while at the same time strengthening the commitment of his followers. Despite the minority discontent from within the Mongol ranks, Temujin's new system proved immediately effective. By postponing the looting until the end of the campaign, Temujin's army amassed more goods and animals than ever before. But the new wealth system also posed a new problem. The Mongols had not only defeated the Tatars, they had also captured almost the entire army and all the civilians. In traditional steppe systems of thought, everyone outside the kinship network was an enemy, and would always be an enemy unless somehow brought into the family through ties of adoption or marriage. Temujin sought an end to the constant fighting between such groups, and he wanted to deal with the Tatars the same way that he had dealt with the Jurchen and the Tayanchut clans. Kill the leaders and absorb the survivors and all their goods and animals into his tribe. Although this policy had worked with clans of hundreds, however, the Tatars were a tribe of thousands. For such a massive social transformation, he needed the full support of his followers, and to achieve that support, he summoned a Hurultai of his victorious warriors. The members of the Hurultai agreed to the plan, determining to kill Tatar males taller than the linchpin holding the wheels on a cart, which was not only a measure of adulthood, but a symbolic designation of the nation itself. In much the same way that maritime people often use the ship as a symbol of their state. Once again, as a counter to the killing, Temujin wanted the surviving Tatars taken in as full members of his tribe, not as slaves. To stress this, he not only adopted another Tatar child for his mother, but also encouraged intermarriage. Until this time, he had only one official wife, Bort, who bore him 4 sons and an unknown number of daughters. But he now took the aristocratic Tatar Yesugen and her elder sister Yesu as additional wives. The Tatars had had a much greater reputation than the Mongols, and after this battle, the Mongols took in so many Tatars, many of whom rose to high office and great prominence in the Mongol Empire, that the name Tatar became synonymous with, and in many cases better known than the name Mongol, leading to much historic confusion through the centuries. Intermarriage and adoption would not suffice, however, to achieve Temujin's goal of merging the 2 large groups into one people. If kin groups were allowed to remain essentially intact, the larger group would eventually fragment. In 1203, therefore, the year after the Tatar conquest, Temujin ordered yet another, and even more radical, reformation of the Mongol army and tribe. He organized his warriors into squads, or arban, of 10, who were to be brothers to one another. No matter what their kin group or tribal origin, they were ordered to live and fight together as loyally as brothers. In the ultimate affirmation of kinship, no one of them could ever leave the other behind in battle as a captive. Like any family of brothers in which the eldest had total control, the eldest man took the leadership position in the Mongol Arban, but the men could also decide to choose another to hold this position. 10 of the squads formed a company, or zagun, of 100 men, one of whom they selected as their leader. And just as extended families united to form lineages, 10 Mongol companies formed a battalion, or mingan, of 1,000 men. 10 mingan were then organized into a tumen, an army of 10,000. The leader of each tumen was chosen by Temujin, who knew the qualities needed in such a leadership position. He allowed fathers and sons and brothers and cousins to stay together when practical, but by forcing them into new units that no man could desert or change, under penalty of death, he broke the power of the old system lineages, clans, tribes, and ethnic identities. At the time of his reorganization, he reportedly had 95 mingan, units of 1,000. But since some of the units were not staffed to capacity, the total number of troops may have been as low as 80,000. The entire Mongol tribe became integrated by means of the army. Under this new system, all members of the tribe, regardless of age or gender, had to perform a certain amount of public service. If they could not serve in the military, they were obliged to give the equivalent of one day of work per week for public projects and service to the Khan. This included caring for the warriors' herds, gathering dung for fuel, cooking, making felt, repairing weapons, or even singing and entertaining the troops. In the new organization, all people belonged to the same bone. Temujin the boy, who had faced repeated rejections ascribed to his lower status birth, had now abolished the distinction between black bone and white bone. All of his followers were now one united people. Historical speculation abounds as to how Temujin adopted the decimal organization of his people. Some of the earlier Turkic tribes used a similar military organization based on units of 10, and Temujin may well have borrowed it from them. Temujin, however, not only utilized the system as a military tactic for war, but he also employed it as the permanent structure for the whole society. Temujin's solution was quite similar to that of the Athenian lawgiver Cleisthenes nearly 2,000 years earlier, though there is no reason to believe that Temujin had ever heard of this piece of history. In order to cut through traditional rivalries and feuds in Athens, Cleisthenes abolished the tribes and reassigned everyone to 10 units of 10, thereby transforming a tribal city into a city-state that grew into the strongest military, commercial, artistic, and intellectual power along the eastern shore of the Mediterranean Sea. Virtually the same reform would produce even more astonishing results for the Mongols on the steppes of Inner Asia. After reorganizing his army, Temujin instituted one further, seemingly small reform. While keeping his main camp at Avaraga on the Hurlin River, he decided to create a closed territory as the homeland of the Mongol tribe at the headwaters of the Onan, Hurlin, and Tul rivers around the holy mountain Burhan Haldun, where he found refuge from the Merkit. "Let no one set up camp at the source of the three rivers," he commanded. With that order, the Mongol homeland was closed to all outsiders, except for the Mongol royal family, who buried their dead there for the next 2 centuries, and who returned there for familial ceremonies and closed family meetings without outsiders. The Mongols had always considered the mountains where the three rivers originated as their homeland, but with this new law, it became the secret ritual center of what would eventually be the Mongol Empire. The land around Burhan Haldun now became officially sacred in the Mongol cosmography, occupying not only the center of the earth, but the center of the universe. Instead of using a single ethnic or tribal name, Temujin increasingly referred to his followers as the people of the felt walls, in reference to the material from which they made their gurs. The adoption of this term after the defeat of the Tatars offers perhaps the first indication that he had an ambition to unite all the people on the steppe. With the defeat and incorporation of the mighty Tatars, as well as the lesser groups of Tayachut and Jurkin, Temujin gained significant prestige in the world of the steppes, a degree of power unanticipated by Ong Khan, his longtime overlord. Even as Temujin consolidated his rule over his greatly enlarged following, he would confront yet another great challenge that would put his new system to a decisive test. His next move would drive his lifelong rival Jamukha into an alliance with his ritual father Ong Khan to combat Temujin's growing might and popularity. Chapter 3. War of the Khans. all the tribes were of one color and obedient to his command. Ata Malik Juveni, Genghis Khan, The History of the World Conqueror. Everyone realized that Ong Khan was nearing the end of his career, but no one knew who would take over for him. After more than 20 years of struggle, Temujin controlled most of the Mongols, but he had not yet conquered his rival Jamuk. Ong Khan, while generally siding with Temujin, had continued to play the two subordinate Khans off against one another. In 1203, the year of the pig, and 1 year after the Tatar victory, Temujin decided to bring the issue out into the open and resolve it by requesting a marriage between Ong Khan's daughter and Temujin's eldest son, Joch. If Ong Khan accepted the proposed marriage, it would be acknowledgement of Temujin as the favorite over Jamuk. With urging from Sengum, his biological son, who had little talent and no following of his own, Ong Khan haughtily refused the marriage. Even if Temujin fancied his followers as the people of the Felt Walls and refused to recognize the distinction between clans, in the eyes of the aristocratic Caryid royal family, Temujin, no matter how useful he may have been to them, was a common upstart. Nearly a century later, Marco Polo, assuming that Temujin had asked for the bride for himself, recorded the tone, if not the actual words of Ong Khan, as later recounted to him by the Mongols. "Is not Genghis Khan ashamed to seek my daughter in marriage? Does he not know that he is my vassal and my thrall? Go back to him and tell him that I would sooner commit my daughter to the flames than give her to him as his wife." The aging Khan, however, quickly regretted his impetuous refusal and grew fearful of how Temujin would respond. Without question, Temujin now ranked as the best military leader on the steppe, and Ong Khan knew that he could not risk coming against Temujin in battle. Instead, he devised a plan to rid himself of the potential danger posed by Temujin through trickery, just as the Tatars had killed Temujin's father. Ong Khan dispatched a message to Temujin, informing him that he had changed his mind and would welcome a marriage between their families. He set a date and invited Temujin to come with his family to celebrate the wedding between their offspring. Apparently, Temujin trusted the Khan, who had been his ritual father for more than 2 decades, and set out with a small party toward the designated rendezvous for the wedding feast, leaving his army behind. This marriage, if he successfully concluded it, could be the zenith of his career by uniting all the people already under his rule with the Caryid under Ong Khan, and the marriage would put him in the strongest position to succeed Ong Khan as the future ruler of the Central Steppes. Only about 1 day's ride from Ong Khan's court, Temujin learned that the wedding invitation was a plot against him. Ong Khan had assembled his army secretly and intended to kill him and wipe out his family. Just at the moment of Temujin's anticipated triumph, he found that not only was the union not to take place, but that his very life and the survival of his family were endangered. With only a small contingent of warriors and far away from his main body of supporters, Temujin could not risk a fight. Instead, he did what steppe people had always done in the face of overwhelming odds. Temujin ordered his small group to disperse quickly in all directions, while he himself and a few companions fled rapidly toward the east before Ong Khan's army began the pursuit. Temujin now faced a crisis that would be the greatest test of his abilities. His flight before the warriors of Ong Khan must have seemed so much like his flight more than 2 decades earlier from the Merkid when they kidnapped Borta. The endless cycle of steppe raids seemed to never end. despite everything he had done in his life. Little had really changed, as he, once again, fled from those who were ranked socially higher above him and politically far more powerful. With their unprepared leader on the run, Temujin's newly amalgamated tribe of the people of the Felt Walls faced its first major threat. Could it hold? Would the people of so many different tribes and families keep their allegiance and confidence in Temujin wherever he was now fleeing? Or would they flee back to their original homelands, or hastily seek to make arrangements for themselves under the protection of Onkan or Jamukha? The events that followed became legendary among the Mongols as the greatest trial and triumph in Temujin's life. Exhausted and without provisions after days of constant flight, Temujin reached the distant shores of muddy Lake Baljuna. He looked around him to see how many men had survived the flight. He counted only 19 of his men, and they now faced the possibility of starvation in this remote exile. As they paused to recuperate by the waters of Baljuna and decide what to do, a wild horse unexpectedly appeared from the north, and Temujin's brother Kasar set out in pursuit of it. He brought the horse down, and the men quickly skinned it. Without flaming wood over which to roast meat or pots in which to boil it, they relied on their ancient cooking technique. After skinning the horse, they cut up the meat and made a large bag from the horse hide into which they put the meat and some water. They gathered dried dung to make a fire, but they could not put the hide kettle directly on the fire. Instead, they heated rocks in the fire until glowing hot. Then they dropped the hot rocks into the mixture of meat and water. The rocks heated the water, but the water prevented the rocks from burning through the bag. After a few hours, the starving men feasted on boiled horse flesh. Aside from Kasar, the men gathered with him were his friends, not his relatives. Some of his family members were temporarily lost on the steppe, but other relatives had deserted Temujin to join Onkan or Jamukha. In particular, his uncle, one of his father's two brothers, who had helped him to kidnap Temujin's mother from her murdered husband, had joined Onkan against his own nephew. With little to comfort them or offer encouragement for the future, the exhausted men seized upon the appearance of the horse as a supernatural gift that offered them more than just food for their empty bellies. As the most important and honored animal in the Mongol world, the horse solemnized the occasion and served as a sign of divine intervention and support. The horse symbolized the power of Temujin's destiny and its sacrifice. As before any major battle or hurultai, not only fed the men, but further empowered Temujin's spirit banner. With only the muddy water of Baljuna to drink at the end of the horseflesh meal, Temujin Khan raised one hand to the sky, and with the other he held up the muddy water of Baljuna in a toast. He thanked his men for their loyalty and swore never to forget it. The men shared in drinking the muddy waters and swore eternal allegiance to him. In the retelling of the episode in oral history, it became known in history as the Baljuna Covenant, and acquired a mythic aura as the lowest point in the military fortunes of Temujin Khan, but also as the event out of which the identity and form of the Mongol Empire would arise. The event acquired a symbolic representation of the diversity of the Mongol people based on mutual commitment and loyalty that transcended kinship, ethnicity, and religion. The 19 men with Temujin Khan came from 9 different tribes. Probably only Temujin and his brother Kasar were actually from the Mongol clans. The others included Merkid, Khitan, and Kariad. Whereas Temujin was a devout shamanist who worshipped the eternal blue sky and the god mountain of Burhan Haldun, the 19 included several Christians, three Muslims, and several Buddhists. They were united only in their devotion to Temujin and their oath to him and each other. The oath sworn at Baljuna created a type of brotherhood, and in transcending kinship, ethnicity, and religion, it came close to being a type of modern civic citizenship based upon personal choice and commitment. This connection became a metaphor for the new type of community among Temujin's followers that would eventually dominate as the basis of unity within the Mongol Empire. After hiding at Baljuna, Temujin formulated his plan to counterattack. He knew that he had to move quickly while Ong Khan was still basking in his false confidence of having permanently rid himself of Temujin's threat. Temujin dispatched word of his plan to his followers scattered across the steppe, and the story probably contained all the details of the miraculous appearance of the horse that saved him and his men. In the following days, to a degree that Temujin himself possibly had not expected, his newly organized army, units of tens and hundreds, reassembled themselves across the steppe. As Temujin marched westward from Baljuna back toward the lands of Ong Khan, his men returned to him from all directions. In addition, some of Temujin's relatives, through his mother and through his wife Borta, ones who had been loyal followers of Ong Khan, now deserted their Caryid leader and came searching for Temujin's camp. Meanwhile, to celebrate his victory over Temujin, the still unsuspecting Ong Khan organized a large feast in his palatial golden gir that he took wherever he went. Overconfident in his own power over his followers, and unaware of what was happening out on the steppe, Ong Khan celebrated in the illusion that Temujin's followers had been disbanded, and that Temujin himself was far away in the east. Temujin's army raced toward the place of the feast. Loyal followers had gone ahead of them to station reserves of horses, so that as one set tired out, another awaited his men. With these remounts, his army raced, without pause, through the dead of night, in what he called the lightning advance. Rather than approaching the Caryid court directly across the steppe, which would have been the easy approach, Temujin took his men over a more remote and difficult pass that he knew would not be guarded. Suddenly, Temujin, who was thought to be several days' ride away, swooped down on the revelers. His men had surrounded the entire camp. Over the next 3 days of hard fighting, the Caryid retreated before the advancing army of Temujin. Many of the followers of Ong Khan deserted to Temujin's banner, and, as was his known policy, he accepted them so long as they had not committed an act of treachery or harm to their former leader, other than to abandon him in favor of Temujin. Ong Khan's army was not so much defeated as swallowed by Temujin's forces. The Caryid court fled in different directions, with each man for himself. Ong Khan's son fled south, and, after being abandoned by his own servants, died of thirst in the desert, while Jamaka and his shrinking followers fled west toward the territory of the Naiman, the last of the three great steppe tribes not yet defeated by Temujin. Ong Khan also tried to make his way alone to the sanctuary of the Naiman tribe. Having failed to capture the leader of his enemies, or even the son of the old Khan, the Mongols had to account for this failure and dismiss its importance. Temujin's supporters spread stories to denigrate Ong Khan's reputation and to assure people on all sides he was dead and no longer a threat. According to the account circulated by the Mongols, after arriving safely at the Naiman border, Ong Khan encountered a border guard who, refusing to believe that the solitary old man was the renowned warrior Khan of the Caryid, killed him. They said that to atone for the killing of Ong Khan, the Naiman queen had his head brought to her and placed on a sacred white cloth of felt in the position of honor at the back of the Ger, opposite the door, where she could make offerings and prayers to it. Nothing could be more offensive to Mongol sensibilities than such a bloody item inside the home, and nothing could be more dangerous than the head, the seat of Ong Khan's soul. According to the story, however, she ordered a musician to play the Morin Hur, the horsehead fiddle, while her daughters-in-law sang and danced for the head, while she made ceremonial offerings of wine to it, as though Ong Khan were still alive and an honored guest in her ger. When Taiyang Khan, the Naiman ruler, entered and saw the severed head, he panicked and shouted in horrified anger that the head had smiled at him. Whereupon he kicked the head off the sacred felt cloth, and then trampled it to pieces. Such stories offered assurance that the old Khan was truly dead, and at the same time they heaped shame and opprobrium on the court of the Naiman, the next target of Temujin's campaign. Propaganda and control of public opinion were quickly emerging as Temujin's primary weapons of choice. The Mongols spread stories among their supporters, accusing the aging Taiyang Khan of having disintegrated into an imbecile and weakling whose wife and son despised and shamed him in public. To build anger among their followers against the enemy, the Mongol leaders spread the story that the Naiman queen despised Mongols as dirty and smelly savages. Using gossip as a way to build confidence in their own men and to weaken the enemy's resolve, the Mongols reported that the son of Taiyang Khan mockingly called him Old Woman Taiyang, and that he would not venture any farther from his ger than would a pregnant woman going to piss. At the same time that they spread such strange stories about the Naiman court, the Mongols boosted their own spirits with stories of how afraid the Naiman were of them. Since Jamaka had joined the Naiman, stories circulated of how he would terrify them with descriptions of Temujin's warriors. The secret history recounted the horrific description of the Mongols in proud detail. They have chisels for noses and sharp awls for tongues. They can live by eating the dew and riding the wind. They compared Temujin to a starved falcon, but also said that his whole body is made from copper and iron fastened so tightly together that no awl could penetrate it. By contrast to this description, the first Mongol captured by a Naiman advance guard rode a horse so skinny with a saddle so primitive that the captors sent the horse and saddle from camp to camp in mockery to convince their fellow Naiman of how pathetic the Mongols had become. Temujin responded to the captured horseman episode with another trick. Since he had far fewer soldiers than the Naiman, Temujin ordered each man to set 5 campfires every night on the hills where his army camped. From a distance, the small army appeared much larger, since they seemed to have more fires than the stars in the sky. The final battle for control of Mongolia came in 1204, the year of the rat, about 300 miles west of Burhan Haldun. In the days leading up to the battle, Temujin tested his new military organization based on squads of 10. Rather than committing to an all-out battle, which he might easily lose because of his smaller numbers, Temujin picked at the Naiman with small and unpredictable hit-and-run skirmishes. In the first episode, Temujin ordered his men to advance in what was called the moving bush or tumbleweed formation just before daylight. Rather than large units racing into attack, the dispersed squads of 10 advanced severally and silently from different directions while keeping their profiles low in the pre-dawn darkness. This prevented the enemy from seeing how many there were, or from preparing for an attack from a single direction. After attacking, the squads fled in different directions, leaving the enemy wounded but unable to retaliate before the attackers disappeared. Temujin followed the sporadic attacks of the moving bush with the lake formation, in which a long line of troops advanced fired its arrows, and then was replaced by the next line. Like waves, they struck and then disappeared as quickly as they had appeared. Each wave, in turn, returning to the rear